Well, this morning I'd like to talk for a few minutes about working with mental content, the content of our mind. And this includes everything really that's going on in our mind and heart at any one moment. The four foundations of mindfulness describe, firstly, working with body. This is in the Satipatthana Sutta. Body includes breath, includes contact, touch, senses. The second region, territory of mindfulness are the feelings. That means the responses to the contact with the world. What happens when we make contact? We like, we don't like, we push, we pulled, we're changed by it or not. The third is all the mental content. And the fourth is consciousness itself, or the Dharma. So I'd like to just to talk for a few minutes about working with mental content. Obviously, thought and mental content is the most powerful of these foundations. It has a very, very powerful grip on us. In some way, it makes us, because we define ourselves and we describe ourselves through our mental content. The continuous stream of voices, messages, whether we are aware or not aware, telling us who we are, what we do, what we think, what we're going to do, what is our future, what is our past, what is our memory. That's us. So clearly this stream of mental activity is extremely powerful. It's our personality, it's our story, and we hold on to it for dear life. It's also very powerful in the world. The assumptions are the most powerful things that are known. The Buddha said there's nothing lasting so long as a human idea. Everything changes except ideas. And the power of the assumed statements we make about the world is enormous. If we think just for 1 minute of the huge tragedy that we could say the world is in the middle of, an extended almost fatal crisis, and that's just because of an assumption that the world is for me and I can do what I like with it. I can pour concrete on it, I can cut trees, I can pollute the seas, I can do it because it belongs to me. That's an assumption, it's part of our mental content, and you can feel how the power of it and the tragedy of it, because it's so strong and so total. But at the same time, if we work with mental content, it becomes the same power can help us and can be a tool for freedom. So the act of dropping. By the way, as we move through life, the act of dropping stuff, dropping our mental content as we go, is an extremely powerful tool for freedom. Because once it's gone, it no longer holds us. Once we see through this illusion of power of these, this mental content, then it's gone. And we can find immense freedom and relief through dropping mental baggage. It's a long process. There was an interesting survey done by psychologists at Harvard University on students who were sitting the 3-month retreat at IMS in America. And they found that in the course of the 3-month retreat, the vast majority of people there were doing what they called self-psychology, which you might call, we might call in this context or with this language, working with mental content, bringing it up and letting it go. Whereas a very, very small proportion of the people there said that they were spending their time in the period of the interview in, I would say, sacredness or the spiritual dimensions of freedom. So people were working through stuff. And that's a major story of what we do and what we need to do. Work back through our conditioning, letting it go, bit by bit. It's very interesting that the psychology in the East, which is a huge knowledge, and I won't touch it, and I'm not the expert on it, but the Abhidharma psychology is vast. But one thing that is really, to me, very, very inspiring is the concept of aggregates. And the aggregates meaning pieces that we put together. Aggregates is like a collection. And that we are made, and the world itself is made through all the elements, pieces that are forming and reforming and forming again and reforming and forming again and reforming. They come together again and again. And they come together in the same shape because of tendencies, nityot. We could say because of past tendencies, hidden tendencies, like as if they, all the little elements have a little label on them saying memory. And because they have the label on them, they know where to go. And they come back. But on the psychological level, which is very much what this is about, it means that at the essential level, there is freedom. And the only reason that these things, these elements of our consciousness keep coming back together again in the same shape is because we are attached to them, because they keep having the same tendency. But if we let go of the tendency, they don't need to come back in the same shape. So there's something original and extremely free in this psychology. There's no sense of original sin. Like the kind of the Christian concept, we are made sinful, we are made heavy and conditioned. It's a sense that we are continually remade and reborn and remade at every second, but because of a tendency and basically because of attachment, we tend to be reborn in the same shape every second. But there is plenty of room for letting it go. And I think it's an inspiring, deep philosophy, an inspiring philosophy of the human soul, with a fundamental statement that we are underneath made free and made blissful and made open. That's the nature of reality. It's important for us to understand that if we have a strong message that goes through our life, and we heard one yesterday in the story of the documentary that Yaffa, I think, mentioned, of a young boy that was abused. And it simply stuck to him on and on and on. And you could see the power of this event, this experience, was so powerful it created waves, echoes, right through the life. And the power is in the threat or in the damage. I am injured, and that's an attachment. And it's not, as Christopher was saying, it's not the injury, it's the way we keep attaching ourselves to it that holds this thing, and we can't let it go all our life. And so in a sense, attachment to the problem is the problem, not the problem itself. It's the attachment to the problem is the problem. And a lot of the issues, the problems that we have in our life, why we are attached to them is that they are in the realm of ignorance, avidya, not knowing. So we circle around them like a moth around a flame. We don't touch them directly, we just keep circling all through our life around issues, and because they are untouched or unmet, they stay and we circle around them, and we are basically attached to them, and we reform ourselves through them all the time. Our story repeats itself again and again and again. So if there's a strong emotional issue, and especially survival issue, threat issue, damage issue, it has power to keep repeating, putting ourselves in the same situation, reforming ourselves in the same situation. So in terms of practice, one of the first lessons to learn to work with mental content is that, in contrast to other approaches, which I don't say this is better, but this is different, we don't get so involved in the story itself, but we try and take nutrition away from it. We try not to keep feeding the story again and again, even if we think we can solve the story by our intelligence. And sometimes we can. We can put our intelligence in it and we can understand more. But in the specific framework of this practice, we tend not to get into the story. Not entirely. Sometimes we do get into the story. Sometimes it's good, as I heard it described, to kind of roll up your sleeves and say, right, what's this story? Get your hands dirty. Okay, sometimes, I'm not saying that we should never do it, it's not a rule, but in general, we tend to try and take the food out of the attachment to the story. That means learning to bring it up, learning to let it go. Learning to bring it up, learning to let it go. Learning to let it flower, in the words of Krishnamurti. Let it flower. So we have something inside us, can be a fear, can be a, like I said, some damage, some hurt, some regret, some judgment of ourselves, which is so common. Letting it flower, because it flowers by itself, we don't have to actually do anything, we just have to stand there and be with it. Letting it flower and letting it go, because it will go. And by itself, when the lunch bell rings, all self-judgment disappears. Gone. Gone. The experience of it having gone is a very, very important experience. Now, in my first retreats, I couldn't understand why. There used to be a slogan that the meditation teachers used to say, remember what it's like not to have a toothache. Remember what it's like not to have a toothache or a headache. And I really couldn't quite understand why this emphasis on not headache. And I was trying to work out, what is a not headache? But it's the full experience of not having issues or not having problems is as important as the problem. Because what we're trying to do is fully experience the truth. And therefore, when the thing is gone, fully experience that it's gone. And that way we can be reborn. At that minute, we are reborn into a new world. And if we take that world seriously, we don't say, oh well, the world of being alright is just temporary, and the world of being not all right is the real world, and I've got to work through that stuff all the time. Well, so again, we're not allowing ourselves to be fully reborn in the world of truth, which is freedom. So we need to actually see two things in mental content. One is the fact that even though they're so powerful, they fly past us like nothing. They fly like clouds. They just fly past. If we try and catch a thought, it's really not so easy. If we try and see what a thought is, it's like trying to catch something that's uncatchable. And then we think, well, if it's so uncatchable, why is it having such tremendous power over me? The thought like self-judgment. I'm no good, I'm this, this kind of stream. Well, if I can't catch it, so why is it making me feel like that all the time, all the time, all the time? And the answer is because it reforms and reforms and reforms and reforms. Comes back and it comes. So firstly, to see and take away the power of thought, because it's not that important, and we have to begin to have a relationship with mental content in which it just isn't that interesting anymore, and that's taking away the food from it, the nutrition. See it as it passes. The other side is seeing its power, in other words, seeing the attachment side of it. It's actually in the language. If you, in English, I think in Hebrew, in English to say to understand something, you say comprehend. And prehend is from the Latin for hand, for grasping. It means to grasp. Comprehend means to grasp. And I think in Hebrew also, litfos mashu. But when you think about litfos tfisa, it's this. It's not that. It's this. It's the fist. It's the attachment. So in the nature of understanding and thinking, there is attachment. And it's good to know it a little bit, to see it, that it's, there's something tight even in the nature of a thought. And the most radical, one of the most radical teachers about this is Krishnamurti, who wasn't a Buddhist particularly, but he certainly met this truth and was more radical about it than any Buddhist teachers that I know, including Christopher. I mean, I brought a short quotation about what he says about thought, which is extremely radical, and it's just worth being aware of this. He says, "All life is energy. It is endless movement. And that energy in its movement creates a pattern. And this pattern is based on self-protection and security. That is, on our survival. Energy, movement, getting caught in a pattern of survival and repeating that pattern over and over, that's the beginning of thinking." Okay, all life is energy, it's endless movement. And that energy in its movement creates a pattern, the pattern based on self-protection, security, that is survival. So he's saying that energy in movement is formed into patterns by our need for survival, by what's happened, by our story, by our conditioning. Energy, movement, getting caught in a pattern of survival, an attachment to our survival. This is beginning of thought. He basically says thought is unnecessary. It's a result. It's a consequence of attachments, of security. It's like a rubbish bin. It's for solid. It's where we throw stuff. It's just, this is in contrast to our sense or our usual view that thought is really, really important. Here, it's another view. thought is a result and a consequence of attachment to survival, to insecurity, and so on and so on. I think we can feel that, or we can sense it in meditation. We can begin to sense a little bit the passing nature of thought, including a thought that we think is very important about us. That maybe before, when we were outside, we weren't sitting, we had some thoughts that we felt were really important about ourselves, for example, who we are, or what we do, or what we want to do, or and held important. And inside here, suddenly things change. We have a bigger landscape of reality. We are with our body, we are breath, we are with the air outside. And it's not so important anymore. And that experience, if we just reflect on that, it can give us a sense that maybe this thought is not as crucial, important as we give it the power. We don't need maybe to give it so much power. So what do we do in practice, practically, about patterns of thinking such as self-judgment or any other patterns, fantasy, future thinking, planning, regret, everything. Firstly, we need to notice it, because if we don't notice it, again, we're like the moth around the flame. We keep circling around and we don't actually get to see it. So surfacing it, if it's a vague discomfort, for example, we feel a little bit chose menucha in our body, maybe it's going with a certain stream of thought. And that moment, perhaps we can catch the stream of thought and open it and see what it says. And we can say, oh, okay, self-judgment, for example. Okay, self-judgment. Here we are, here it is again. The judge. Okay, I met you, I know you. Bye-bye. So we meet him and let him go. We meet the thought, we see it passing, and we let it go again. So noticing is important, and noticing also if it's very strong, like judgment can be, for example, or criticism of self or others can be very strong, trying to get a sense of what the emotion that drives it. Where is the engine that drives this pattern? What does it feel like? What is the emotional engine that keeps this thing going? And we might feel that in the body. Also that, maybe we feel it somewhere in the body or somewhere in the heart. And just being aware of that pattern, emotion driving thought, thought cycling back with emotion, some kind of collection of all of this together to create feelings in the body, feelings of pleasant or painful. And being aware a little bit, if we are quite still, we may also be able to play a little bit with the whole issue of observer and observed. Where is the observer in all of this? As we are with our thoughts, what about the observer and what about the observed? What is the object here? Because in a way thoughts are us, so is us watching us? And so it's a little bit of reflection here, or a little bit of a sense that you can look at it perhaps as closeness or further away. Doesn't matter really how you phrase it, but the sense of observer and observed is a reflection, an understanding or a wisdom that can come from attention to thinking or mental content. And as I say, knowing when things are not there is important, knowing when there is little mental content, knowing when there is peace and calm, knowing that too, and knowing when mental content arises and when it disappears, when it's soft and when it's strong, when there is emotion driving it and when there's no emotion driving it, seeing the way this flows one to another, calm and insight flowing one to another, changing one to another. So the finally, the background to all of this needs to be anchoring, to be anchored, to be the organ of the breath and our samadhi. We have to keep returning to samadhi, especially if we work with mental content, because our samadhi gives us the basis, plus the equanimity, the steadiness, the sitting through things. That gives us the basis to be able to hold and let flower our mental content without getting totally caught in it and sent away and sucked in it and disappearing. If we find ourselves disappearing for a long period of time in mental content, the mind is turning for a whole meditation session, as I said, try and do anything to pull out the plug. Stand up, open the eyes, take a few deep breaths, realize you're stuck in it for a whole 45 minutes. Do anything to pull out the plug of the video. You're caught in a movie, could be a good movie, could be a bad movie, doesn't matter, you're caught in the movie, just try and get out of it somehow or other. Start again, begin the practice again, with breath, with body. So the breath and the body are the place we keep coming back to all the time. That's our base, that's our home, that's our strong base, that's our anchor. And from there we can open out into mental content if we feel, if we are ready, if we feel that that's a direction we want to go into. We don't have to. We can stay with the calm and the samadhi by itself. We can just stay with our breath. If we feel clear and steady, this is also the time to open a little bit more. Open to receptivity, open to senses. When we're walking, allow a little bit more in sometimes. Be aware, again, the anchor would be the touch of the ground, the small things on the ground, the pebbles, whatever. The sense of being in contact, closely, intimately, intimacy. But at times, we can open out. We can feel the trees, we can feel the sense of the air on our face, or the sense of being in a big world, sense of space around us. Being receptive, allowing our senses to receive, to be washed with incoming, soft incoming messages. Just to be in that world of the senses, awake, alive, present, and open. And we can do this in the meditation hall. Sometimes sound can help us very much to do this, because the nature of sound as a sense, as one of the sense doors, is very, very open and non-specific and non-penetrating. So we can get a feeling of openness by starting with sound and then including other things coming into us. So I'd like to finish with one of my favorite poets, who's William Blake. And he says something about letting things go. There's a short poem, maybe you know it. He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses a joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. So he who binds to, who ties, holds on, he who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses a joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. So let's sit together quietly for a while. We have half an hour.